Today's episode is an incredible episode on how to prevent allergies for your baby. I just wish I had heard this episode with Claudia Gray before I had my own children. I asked Claudia questions on how to prevent allergies and what allergens really parents should be watching out for. And she went into a really deep dive all the way from pregnancy through to weaning your baby, and then how to manage allergies. If you are thinking about having a baby, weaning a baby, feeding a baby, and exposing them to allergens in the environment, this is an episode that you absolutely must not miss.
Welcome to Sense by Meg Fora, the podcast that's brought to you by ParentSense, the app that takes guesswork out of parenting. If you're a new parent, then you are in good company. Your host, Meg Fora, is a well-known OT, infant specialist, and the author of 8 parenting books. Each week, we are going to spend time with new mums and dads just like you to chat about the week's wins, the challenges, and the questions of the moment. Subscribe to the podcast, download the ParentSense app, and catch Makia every week to make the most of that first year of your little one's life. And now, meet your host.
Welcome back, mums and dads, to Sense by Meg Fora. This week, the sense is not coming from Meg Fora. The sense is coming from one of my special guests. And as you know, we have different episodes on this podcast, and sometimes we chat to real mums who are at the rock face with newborn babies. And sometimes we speak to people who know a lot more than I do about a specific topic. And the topic for today is allergies, allergy prevention. How do we know if our baby has an allergy and what can we do about it? And so there's nobody who I would rather be speaking to about this than Dr. Claudia Gray. Claudia is a pediatrician based in Cape Town, South Africa. She runs an exceptionally busy practice, and allergy has been one of her passion areas. So Claudia, very warm welcome to you today.
Thank you, Meg. Thanks for inviting me to the podcast.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful to chat. And it's such a topical theme. And in fact, almost every time I speak to mums about weaning, the question of allergy comes up because people are wanting to prevent that allergy march or prevent those allergies from developing, but they're wanting to wean their babies. And Claudia, back in the day when my firstborn was born, there was this theory that you had to keep all allergens away from babies completely, even in pregnancy, avoid peanuts in pregnancy and don't introduce wheat until 9 months. It was all these guidelines that we followed fastidiously. And of course, that theory's really changed. So I'd love to kick off and talk about weaning and the role of weaning in allergy prevention.
Okay, thanks, Meg. Yeah, so ironically, all that advice about delayed introduction and avoidance has almost backfired and has run in parallel with what we call the allergy epidemic, so to say. But let me start by just telling your listeners what an allergy actually is, just to set the scene. So an allergy is a response by your immune system or your baby's immune system to something that really should be harmless. Okay, so the immune system is getting it a little bit wrong. And you can imagine how complex the immune system is. It's not just one aspect. It's not just when you introduce solids. It's also genetics. It's epigenetic factors. It's factors such as, does the child have eczema? So it's a complex story. So we can give the best advice we can, but not necessarily prevent all allergies. So we shouldn't be having allergies. It's our immune systems getting it wrong and misinterpreting things that should be safe and seeing them as a distress signal, so a parasite, and then setting up a fight against them. So that's the background. Now, initially, when allergies started increasing, we saw a massive increase in respiratory allergies like asthma and allergic noses or allergic rhinitis. And then following shortly on its heels came the food allergy epidemic. And suddenly, all over the world, we're seeing a substantial amount and prevalence of food allergies. In Australia, 10%. In the UK, probably 5 to 8% of children have at least one true food allergy. So it's actually becoming a public health issue. And of course, treatment of food allergies is so very difficult. So the best approach would be prevention. Now, prevention doesn't just start with weaning. Can I divert a little bit, Meg, and just give them factors. So So during pregnancy, the first thing to say is don't cut out any food groups for the sake of allergy prevention. It doesn't work. So if you ate a peanut butter sandwich every day before you fell pregnant, continue to eat a peanut butter sandwich every day. So don't decrease and don't increase dramatically. In terms of sort of supplements, it's still a bit of a messy business, but two or more portions of oily fish or omegas per week seem to be protective, and maybe probiotics, but the jury is largely still out, especially in your last trimester of pregnancy. In the last 3 months, especially if there's a strong family history of allergies. Now, when that little bubba is born, I know we're going to talk about breastfeeding a little bit more, so I'll package that for later, but breast is always best if possible. It's got some allergy protective properties, but not complete. So it's not only about the breastfeeding. But certainly if you're still breastfeeding while you're introducing solids, it's incredibly helpful. Okay, we can talk about formula milks, et cetera, later, but you asked specifically about solids. So as you know, the recommendations pretty much worldwide are that anytime from 17 completed weeks after birth, you can start introducing solids if you have a safe environment and you can prepare it hygienically and if your child is showing signs of readiness. Now, there's no longer any evidence that delaying solids prevents allergies at all, and delaying specific solids. So we now advocate starting with your relatively like bland foods, you know, whatever is appropriate for the family, your apple puree or pear or butternut or sweet potato. But once the kid has got the hang of it, there's no problem in early on, even before 6 months or around 6 months, giving allergens such as peanut butter mixed into your oats or egg blended into some veggies or wheat, you know, also blended into the puree that the little babies initially need. The only exception would be if the child is already showing potential signs of allergy, such as a child riddled with eczema, then rather see your healthcare practitioner and get advice. But in the majority of cases, we've now found that earlier introduction is actually better. And we can go into that a little bit deeper if you want to.
Yeah, so quite interestingly, you said there that there was a warning sign in terms of if your child's riddled with eczema early on. So maybe let's talk about those babies who are showing some sort of, or let's talk about the babies where you would say to the mom, let's really do a deep dive into this. I mean, you've mentioned if they've got eczema, what are the other flags, red flags that the mom should know about in terms of being more cautious with introduction of solids?
Eczema is by far the greatest, Meg. And then the only other one really would be, say you've introduced egg and your child's already reacted to egg, then you're obviously going to be more cautious with the other allergens and rather have them tested. And then the third situation would be if there's a strong family history. So if a sibling has a peanut allergy, you might want to say, look, bring your bubba at 5 months. We'll quickly test for peanuts because the quicker we can get it in, the better, as long as a child isn't already showing signs of the allergy.
Okay, excellent. So what I've heard you say is don't cut out any allergens in pregnancy if you've eaten them before. Do breastfeed, introduce solids and allergens somewhere between 4 and 6 months or 17 weeks and 6 months if there's none of those red flags. So that's super, super helpful. Going a little deeper into eczema, because eczema obviously is something that, well, first of all, why would a baby get eczema before solids are introduced? What's that about?
Okay, so eczema is a very, very misunderstood disease. And it's one of my passions. I actually did my PhD on eczema and food allergies. Eczema is essentially a skin barrier issue. So your skin barrier, the top layer of your skin, which protects you from the environment and infections and allergens and keeps your water in and keeps your nutrients in, that skin barrier is faulty. Now, the most common cause is genetic. So you've just got genes encoding slightly faulty proteins. So they're not as tightly woven, and the skin barrier is not as good. So genetics, and then nowadays we also know that these genetics drive the immune system in the skin. So the local immune system in the skin is faulty. And a lot of this also has to do with what we call the microbiome of the skin. So the layer of bacteria and viruses and all sorts of bugs that live on many surfaces of our body that actually have a huge role to play in the development of our immune system. So genetic, skin barrier issues, and microbiome. And then there is a small percentage of kids who get eczema because of a food allergy. But I just want to reiterate that it's usually the other way around. So there are those babies who have what we call a delayed type cow's milk allergy, who, if they're exposed to cow's milk through formula or through mum's breast milk, develop eczema as a reaction. So not that typical hives and swelling and breathing difficulties. They develop sort of colic and eczema. So that's a possibility, but it's quite rare. So more common is the genetic factor, and much more common is that the eczema then leads to other allergies. And the reason for this is very, very interesting. It's because our broken skin allows the allergens to come in that shouldn't be coming in through the skin. Our skin is pretty stupid when it comes to deciding what's a goodie and our bad and or a baddie. Our gut is very clever. So our gut is designed to meet foods for the first time and realize this is a goodie. Our skin is not designed for that. So if peanut butter from daddy's sandwich goes through a baby's broken skin, that skin immune system could make the wrong decision and react against it. So some eczema is caused by food allergies, but usually genetic factors and skin barrier factors and microbiome. But a lot of food allergy is caused because the child has eczema, if you can understand that sort of difference in direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's such so interesting. This is a very extreme case that I came across. She might have even been in your practice. But there was a little girl who was born in London, and there was very faulty advice given to the mom when the baby was very little. She had a she was tiny, and she had a nappy rash. And the mom was told to put egg white on the nappy rash for a reason that totally escapes me. Mom's bad advice, don't do it. But she was having this egg white put on her nappy, on her broken skin area. And the first time she had eggs, literally the first time, she ended up with an anaphylactic reaction. So exactly case in point.
Absolutely. And, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when this phenomenon first came to light, that actually maybe we're meeting our allergens through the skin, it was actually, first of all, studied by a very famous allergist called Gideon Lack, because he found that kids using nappy creams or moisturizers with arrakis oil, which is peanut oil, were actually getting more peanut allergies.
Wow.
So that's where that, first of all, that concept came from. And on the other hand, he noticed that, in Israel, the kids are exposed to peanut in the form of the bamba snack very early on in life by mouth. But those kids showed a very low percentage of peanut allergy. So that just explains or illustrates the fact that we want to meet things through our guts and not through our skin.
Very interesting. So, I mean, because the skin is so important in this, how would you, I mean, if a mom came to you and her little one did have eczema, how would you be telling her to treat the eczema? I mean, you don't want to put something with peanut oil or egg in it. And what sort of preparations should we be putting on our baby's eczema? How do we manage it?
Yeah. So to an extent, it depends on the degree of the eczema. And the children who are at highest risk of developing food allergies are those with moderate to severe eczema. So don't panic or stress if the kid just has a few little patches. But that's why in my practice as a pediatric allergist, I call eczema an allergy emergency. Not because it's life-threatening, but it's because it's quality of life-threatening. You can actually develop lifelong conditions if we're not looking after the skin properly because of this chance of developing allergies, etc., via the broken skin. So any rough, broken, itchy, especially itchy skin in babies is an emergency because it's a portal of entry of baddies. So first of all, it's moisturize, 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 but not beautifully fragranced, pink, colorful moisturizers. It needs to be a bland emollient, you know, with occlusive factors. I give my patients sort of a whole list of criteria, but it's an eczema-friendly emollient that you can just go to your pharmacy and ask what is a good emollient for dry skin. And most of them are incredibly safe, even for babies. So studies have had varied results, but I still advocate moisturizing from the word go with a bland moisturizer once or twice a day. Make sure you don't contaminate the container by putting dirty hands that have just changed a nappy into the tub. So wash your hands first, or use a moisturizer that comes out of a tube so that you reduce the rates of infection, because that is a possible side effect. So moisturize, moisturize, moisturize. And then if the skin is already showing signs of inflammation, so red, angry, itchy, it needs an anti-inflammatory. There's a whole lot of taboo about topical cortisone steroids, etc. Yeah, there should be taboo about oral steroids, which people seem to be very happy to give and get. But topical steroids are safe if given at the right concentration for the right amount of time in the right areas. So we need to jump on our eczema skin with early treatment. So certainly see your healthcare practitioner for that, because the earlier we can get the skin right, the less will be our progression to other allergic conditions.
Very, very interesting. Okay, excellent. So now let's turn our attention, because you've mentioned a couple of times this microbiome and you've spoken about the skin microbiome. But there's obviously, and you've alluded to the fact that the gut microbiome is even more powerful and fabulous than the skin microbiome for dealing with new substances and so on. How do we protect our gut microbiome, and how do we set our baby's gut microbiome up to be successful at dealing with allergens?
This episode is brought to us by ParentSense, the all-in-one baby and parenting app that helps you make the most of your baby's first year. Don't you wish someone would just tell you everything you need to know about caring for your baby? When to feed them, how to wean them, and why they won't sleep? ParentSense app is like having a baby expert on your phone guiding you to parent with confidence. Get a flexible routine, daily tips, and advice personalized for you and your little one. Download ParentSense app now from your app store and take the guesswork out of parenting.
How do we set our baby's gut microbiome up to be successful at dealing with allergens?
Yeah, so Meg, this thing called the microbiome has really become the it girl of medicine in the last 10 years or so, I would say. And it's absolutely fascinating and rather difficult to understand. But I think for the purpose of the listeners, we must know that, I always say, we are actually more bug than being. We've got more bugs in us than genes. So the genome of the microbiome, which is all the bugs that we carry in our guts and skins and chest, are far more than the genes we carry. So why is this? And actually, we've found it's because the microbiome actually does a lot of work for us. So these bacteria produce products that help protect the lining of the gut. They produce enzymes, they produce vitamins. So they are actually doing a lot of our function. So we can be jolly grateful for the microbiome. But of course, like everything else, if you look at it like a population of people, you'll have goodies, you'll have baddies, and you'll have neutral people, or political parties for that matter, or countries. And we want the good bugs to be prevalent. So we don't want the bad bugs to take over. And certain situations allow the bad bugs to take over because we're killing our good bugs. So eczema itself is a reason for the skin microbiome to be faulty. The whole inflammatory process allows baddies such as Staph aureus, the bug that causes boils, to overgrow, and our good bacteria are then kind of squashed by the Staph. So that's an example where disharmony has come into play, and that disharmony actually aggravates the eczema. So talking about the gut, how can we get the microbiome right in the gut? Oh, it's a long and interesting story. So the first thing to think about is the mode of delivery, Meg. I will put my hand up and say I needed cesarean sections because I had a small pelvis and my kids wouldn't descend. So I'm not saying that I'm perfect. But if you can deliver by normal vaginal delivery, it is much healthier for the baby's microbiome, because the passage through the vaginal canal already seeds their guts. So that's number one. If you have a choice, some people don't have a choice, like I didn't. And some people, for some people, cesareans are life-saving. But for those who are able to deliver naturally, it's already seeding the gut's microbiome beautifully. Secondly, the best catch-up is breastfeeding. So I call breastfeeding a soup of microbiota. It's absolute gold. Meg's wearing a beautiful golden mustard top, and it reminds me of the gold of breast milk, and then the same as the golden poo that the baby then produces. So breast milk is absolute gold. We cannot get better. It is the most magnificent nutrition. And it's full of prebiotics, which are sort of fiber-like substances which allow healthy bugs to grow. And it's full of probiotics, which are the bugs themselves, the healthy bugs like bifidobacteria. So you, in a little plate, you're giving the child the bugs and the precursors it needs to create a healthy microbiome. So that's breast milk. If you can't breastfeed, so say you've had breast cancer, or you're on chemotherapy or on certain medications, or if you have a delay in establishing breastfeeding, we always punt breast milk. But there are some specific formula milks coming out for cesarean section babies that help with the pre and the probiotics. So just be aware of that. Next thing, skin to skin, skin to skin. Everybody must kiss and cuddle that baby, except the siblings with snotty noses, including the family dog. So it's good to have a varied microbiome around you, cuddling, kissing, playing, skin to skin, the dog muzzling the baby. All of those are generally healthy bacteria that then help to seed the baby's microbiome. Next in line, preventing early antibiotics, if you can. So it's not always possible. But if a baby's got a snotty nose and your doctor thinks it's a virus, don't push for antibiotics, because they can kill off your good bugs for 6 months or more that it takes to regenerate those good bugs in your gut. So that's why things like early antibiotics are associated with later asthma, because it's destroying the microbiome, which is part of our immune system. Antacids, Meg, wow. When you were in South Africa, you would have seen this. I'm hoping that in the UK, the use is a bit more judicious. But antacid medications are handed out to babies as if they're just part of the normal baby schedule. And actually, what does it do? It changes the acidity in your gut. And what does that do? It changes your microbiome. So ironically, the allergy epidemic has paralleled the epidemic in antacid use. Okay, so all these things to think about: antibiotics, antacid, lots of skin to skin, breastfeed, vaginal delivery if possible. And then once the kid is eating, a wide variety of foods, foods with fiber, foods with prebiotics, yogurt with probiotics, et cetera, et cetera. So the wider the variety, the better your microbiome can flourish.
Brilliant. Absolutely fabulous advice. And, you know, I mean, I certainly, my third little one had very, very severe reflux. And actually, she still is lactose intolerant. She has been her whole life. And I was actually, weirdly, I was already a published author, and I really was feeling like this whole reflux lactose intolerance story that was happening at the time was overkill. And then Emily comes along and really, really was quite ill. And she still to this day gets very sick if she has anything with any lactose in it. But I put her on Nexium, and to this day, you know, it's really been something that I've thought, oh, was there any other way I could have handled it? Because I do think in the moment of having a niggly baby, a baby who's unsettled, a baby who we can't get to the bottom of why they're crying, it's just becomes easy to go for the quick fix, which is the medication. And so, you know, when we go to our doctors, you know, we're expecting to have a pill, you know, give me a fix. And, you know, one of the things Kath McGaw, who's a pediatric dietitian who I know you work closely with as well, her and I often say to moms, try and be comfortable with being uncomfortable, with knowing that it's a stage they're moving through. They don't need to be medicated for colicky tummies or gassiness or irritability in the early days. Because I think there's been a lot of pressure on pediatricians and doctors to give us a pill to sort out this niggly baby.
Absolutely. And you know, Meg, as you say, some babies deserve the anti-reflux treatment. So there are babies with true reflux disease. So those who are unable to to drink because their throats and esophagus, those who are aspirating, breathing in their vomit, those who are vomiting so much that they're not gaining weight, or those who are crying 24 hours a day in pain, they need the reflux treatment, but not the baby who's spitting up. I mean, spitting up is absolutely normal. It's a big start to the baby. Babies do spit up. Not the baby who's a little bit niggly, you know, but part of the normal physiological discomfort of a baby. So it's all about degrees, and it's all about, and it's not just the parents, it's the doctors. Like, doctors want a quick fix too. They want to be able to say to the parent, oh, let's try this. It's much harder. Coming from a pediatrician, it's much harder to say to the parents, I don't think we're going to do anything.
Yeah, sit it out.
But often it's much wiser.
Yeah, very interesting. So you mentioned something very interesting just now, and I know this is a question that I get asked often. And you mentioned that, you know, the dog being in the vicinity and maybe even licking the baby was good for their gut microbiome. Is there any evidence or is there any research on pets and pets in homes to either contribute to more allergies or to actually decrease allergies?
Yeah, so not all the research is overwhelmingly conclusive, but it seems that having pets, dogs, cats in the house are actually allergy protective. It's very different, though, if there's no dog or cat in the house and the child's already developed eczema and they've got eczema, and then you decide to get pets into the house, because then the child's probably going to become allergic, because those allergens are going to go through the broken skin. So this really only works if there's a pet in the house from birth.
Okay, interesting.
And then the other thing is, you know, some babies, the allergic babies, say they've got eczema and a peanut allergy or whatever, then sometimes they do develop an allergy to the pet in their home, but they tolerate their own pet, because they've lived in harmony with them for so long. But then they go out of the house to granny's house and she's got a new little terrier, and suddenly they itch and sneeze and rub. So often kids are tolerant to their own pets, but then don't tolerate other people's pets. But certainly it seems that from the word go, it's a much better idea to have pets in the house.
Very, very interesting. So if we've got a little one who has displayed some allergies, so they've maybe come up in hives after having had egg for the third time. And let's talk about those ones where there's a question mark, is this an allergy? And I guess the ultimate question that most parents are asking is, when should I seek help and when do I see a doctor? Like, what are the warning signs that this could be an allergy?
So there are two main types of allergy, Meg. There is the immediate type allergy, which is a lot easier to recognize and to investigate. And there's a delayed type. So let me start with the delayed type. So the delayed type is more subtle. It's not straight after eating the food that you suspect. It really usually presents as gut cramps, maybe diarrhea, maybe eczema. And that's more common in the very young babies with a possible cow's milk and soya allergy. But now when we're talking about the kid who's weaning, we're talking much more about immediate type allergies. So immediate type allergies by definition occur from seconds up to 2 hours after exposure to the allergen. And they present with symptoms such as hives, which are tiny little raised rashes. You can have overproduction of mucus. You can have tearing eyes. You can have tummy cramps. You can have vomiting. You can have throat clearing, you can have coughing, you can have wheezing, you can have difficulty breathing in. So it can vary from very mild, which is normally a few rashes around the mouth, to very severe or life-threatening. Now, if you have given your child food and within 2 hours you see any of those symptoms, all of those children deserve to be seen, because for a few reasons. Number one, food allergies are often misunderstood and they're often overdiagnosed if the parent just makes the decision. So rather have it tested properly. They can be tested for, and easily, skin prick tests, blood tests, and you can even get, you know, the information by the end of your consultation. So rather have it tested, A, to confirm the allergy, B, to see if there are any associated allergies. For example, if you're egg allergic, you're much more likely to be peanuts allergic. So that must be tested as well, because remember, if you're not allergic, you want to get it in as soon as possible to prevent your body from making up its mind in a different way. So test the allergy, test associated allergies, and test alternatives. So if your kid has a cow's milk protein allergy, an immediate type, maybe they're fine with soya. And then there is something, if once they're finished breastfeeding, that they can have that's relatively affordable and palatable, because some of the cow's milk protein allergy formulas are unbelievably expensive and foul tasting. And then, of course, you also need to know what to do in an emergency. So that's super important, a super important reason to go see your healthcare practitioner. Was it a mild reaction that just needs a bit of quick acting antihistamine? Or was it a severe reaction that needs an adrenaline auto-injector like an EpiPen? And then follow up. Every allergy is different. So egg and cow's milk allergy and soya and wheat are often outgrown during childhood, whereas peanut and fish allergies and tree nut allergies and seafood are often not. So there's so many nuances to this. Take the guessing out of it and rather see someone for any suspicion of food allergies.
Very interesting. Sure. I feel like we could keep going for hours. There were a couple of questions that came through that I don't want to miss out on. And one of them is around environmental pollutants and the air that we're breathing. And it was quite interesting. I was watching BBC News yesterday, and there's this crazy level of pollutants that have never been seen before over one of the cities in India, I think it is. And it's just never been seen before. And people are really worrying about children. So there are a couple of questions around the air we breathe. One is, would it be worth getting some sort of air purifier that parents are looking at getting? And another question is, do air cons make allergies worse? So is there anything we should be doing and thinking about with regards to the air that our children breathe?
Yeah, I think this is a very difficult topic, because even if you protect them in your household, they go out into the real world and there will be pollution. So there's no doubt that pollution is bad for your airways and for your airway microbiome, and it increases your chance of developing lung diseases, and it can exacerbate things like asthma. There's no doubt, but we can't avoid it altogether. What about in our household? So generally, if a child is already known to have an environmental allergy, so the air purifiers aren't really there to take the pollution away in the house. It's more to take away the bigger particles, like pollen particles, and maybe if it's a very refined one, house dust mite particles. So I think if your child already has an allergy, think about it, but it's not the be-all and end-all at all. Okay, house dust mite, for example, it's much more important to reduce fluffy toys, reduce fluffy blankets, because dust mite settles. It's not really in the air that much, except if you jump on the bed. And to wash your sheets at higher temperatures, to use special house dust mite covers. So those are more important. For pollen allergies, possibly, but it's also not going to be your absolute answer. Certainly humidifiers we do not advocate, because a lot of allergens like mold and dust mite, they thrive on humidity. So you would actually be propagating them rather than mitigating them. You talked about air cons. I actually haven't seen much evidence about this, Meg, so I don't want to talk out of turn, but air cons are normally dry, so that's good. The only thing that I find is if aircons are blowing directly onto children, I think it's quite an exacerbator, because it can make your nose run. It can create extra mucus. It can make you swallow more mucus and then maybe get coughing attacks. But I don't think it's been found to make allergies worse, except if your aircon is really disgusting and full of mold, etc. So they need to be cleaned regularly and professionally. And then the last thing is, of course, not just mold can grow there, but also bacteria. So something like Legionella, which is a bacterial infection, a lung infection, can be spread through contaminated air conditioners, because you're literally spitting out the bacteria from the aircon. So I am very much for air conditioners because they're comfortable and they're dry, but they need to not be blowing straight onto people, and they also need to be cleaned regularly.
Very interesting. Well, you know, I wish I'd heard this podcast before I had my firstborn, because I just know, and I mean, you know what it's like, you've got four children, you look back and you go, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, and I wish I hadn't done that. My son has terrible environmental allergies, and I mean, it's interesting because we didn't have a dog and then got him a dog when he was one, and I mean, if a dog comes near him, he's so allergic, and you know, and we obviously used humidifiers every night, even in wet Cape Town, you know, and so there were just so many things we did wrong. So I hope this has been super useful for other moms. I think it has been. And yeah, I've really loved chatting, Claudia. It's just amazing to just get a little bit of a, you know, a kind of a smorgasbord of tips to prevent allergies. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the invitation. And if there are any topics you want to delve in into more detail at some stage, maybe we can do that, because today was much more of an overview.
Yeah, no, that's really, really super. And Claudia, I know that your practice is way too busy anyway. Is there any chance that people could look out for you on Instagram, or is there any way that they can see you and come and see you?
Yes, I haven't been active enough on Instagram, but it's Dr. So Dr. _ Claudia, Claudia _ Gray, Gray. And also, Meg, you're a prolific author. So I just want to let your listeners know I'm also just finishing a book on pediatrics and parenting, but much more medical. Yours are much more sense and directed, but mine's a lot more medical, just dispelling some of the myths and debunking and making it much easier. So I'll let you know when.
Wonderful. Do you have a title yet or not yet?
Called Real Parenting and Pediatrics.
Oh, I love it. Oh,
well, it's going to be. I'm just finishing it. So
well, congratulations. Yeah. We will definitely when that book comes out, I'd love to do an episode with you and just promote it, because I know it'll be a fabulous text.
It's so sweet. And I do reference your books in it in almost every chapter. So.
Thank you, Claudia. Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks to everyone who joined us. We will see you the same time next week. Until then, download ParentSense app and take the guesswork out of parenting.